This week's episode is brought to you by Blue Harvest Vintage. Are you a collector? Blue Harvest love to help you find that missing piece you need to complete your collection. They have extensive stock of vintage Star Wars vehicles and mint on card action figures, as well as new The Force Awakens and Black Series items. Blue Harvest have Funko Pops, Lego, Dinky, Corgi, Matchbox and more. Everything a collector could possibly need. If they don't stock it, then let them know, and their knowledgeable staff will be only too pleased to help. Head to Morley Market in Leeds to see the life-size Darth Vader. Alternatively, reach out to Blue Harvest on Twitter, at Blue Harvest UK, Facebook, Blue Harvest Vintage Collectibles, a website, blueharvestvintage.co.uk, or email at blueharvesttoys@gmail.com.
Welcome to TSW After Dark Side. With each passing moment, you become more our listener.
What I thought might be a good idea, Paul, would be for you and I to just have a brief chat. It doesn't have to be very long, because the After Dark Sides are just freeform and they just become whatever they become. And talk about our little project, because we've hinted at it a few times on several podcasts, and I've mentioned it a few times on previous episodes of Talk Star Wars, this thing that we've been doing. And I thought it might be nice if we could perhaps get something down as an MP3 that we could send out to do the work for us.
Simple but perfect idea.
Simple but perfect.
Yeah.
Might not go anywhere, but throw enough mud at the wall, eh? So in 2000, well, let's just, I'll do a proper intro, I suppose, right? This is the Talk Star Wars After Dark Side, so prepare for some possible swearing, probably not from me, because I'm very, very disciplined on these podcasts. In 2012, was it, Paul? We embarked.
I think it was before that, sir.
Was it really?
No, you might be right.
No, it was 2012. I'll tell you what I remember. Two things led to what we ended up doing. One was me being a miserable git on Facebook one day during the whole run-up to the Olympics. So that was definitely 2012. And
All right, okay.
I was having a whine about how all I was hearing was Jubilympics this and Jubilympics that, because it was the Jubilee year as well, 2012. And the media do what they do, and they decided they were going to make two things into one word, because that's funny. And they were saying Jubilympics. And I was having breakfast here, and I put a thing on Facebook saying, if I hear another person say Jubilympics, I'm going to shoot people. And you said, stop being a miserable git. And it kind of, just this one little exchange. Do you not remember that?
No.
No.
I call many people miserable gits, even though I'm probably the miserable git. So.
But it stopped me dead in my tracks, and I thought, do you know what? I was just sitting there, because what had happened, to give you a big picture of what was happening with us at the time, we just bought this house that we're living in now, but we had to tear it apart. And
big time, yeah. You turned it literally into, it was like a husk of coconut shell.
3 months of absolute hell as we rebuilt this house. And then I was just doing that. I was working full time, coming home, doing the house. I didn't really do any, I was project management really, even though my brother-in-law did most of that. But I was here making sure that things went in the right places and answered questions and made decisions. And it was hell. And then when we were done in 2012, everything suddenly stopped, and I was just left exhausted and a little bit grumpy. So that little comment was the last of that for me. And then you said, stop being a miserable git. And I said, you know what? I think he's right. I think I need to do something creative rather than just bitch and wallow. And then the second thing that happened was I heard a podcast that Kevin Smith was on, and it was an audio commentary for one of the Batman films, Dark Knight Rises, I think, that came out that year.
Mm.
And he had said something. Kevin always gets very emotional when he's doing anything, basically, certainly when he's podcasting. And he'd had a couple of tears about the shootings in Aurora. Do you remember
theatre
where the guy said he was the Joker and he went in and murdered a bunch of people? And part of Kevin's Impassioned podcast was, which is the reason I am now a podcaster, he said, be a light in the world. Go and create something, because that's the only true way to counteract all this darkness. And those two things, our interaction that morning and hearing Kevin say something as profound as that, go and be a light in the world, made me decide to do something more creative. So I'll let you talk about what that is for a minute, Paul, because I've been talking for 4 minutes and I think it's probably a good idea if I give you a bit of the stage. So well, what was it?
I've got to do some recollecting. Christ, I don't even know the tense for that word, whatever I'm trying to use. But we were using a thing called, was it Path?
It was Path.
It was Path.
The social network, yeah.
It was Path, yeah. And, well, Mark and I come from this sleepy little place in Kent. I'm not there anymore, actually. That's not totally true. But I'm kind of from there because I spent so many years of my, you know, my youth. We lived in an area called Medway, basically. And one of the key sort of shopping areas when we were kids was this thing called Saver Centre, / Hempstead Valley.
Yeah.
And then one morning I woke up and there's War and Peace in my Path sort of update. And it's Mark. He's like, wow, chaps, got to let you know of this really cool dream I've just had. I'm like, oh, God. But obviously you start reading. Because Path updates were like, I'm having a coffee.
Yeah, sort of yeah. Thing.
But you were talking about this thing, and I'm not going to mention that. Well, they're gone now anyway, but it was – you were talking about – I think it was us. I think we were the antagonist / protagonists in this story you had, where we were in – it was either Four Boys or at the time it was NSS news agents and so on. And did we commit a robbery?
Yeah, we
what
did.
What did we do? We committed a robbery.
The dream was basically it was I'd been swept up. All of us had been swept up in this time travel thing. This guy had recruited us. It was a bit like, I mean, I didn't think this at the time in the dream, but afterwards as we sort of took this thing apart and we started building a story around it, to me it seemed very much like the Thomas Crown Affair. And that in this story, this dream that I had, the Thomas Crown figure was this guy that had gone through time collecting up candidates to use in a robbery. And they went, he took us all back in time.
Right, that's great.
The Hempstead Valley of our youth, our youth, yeah. Our collective youth.
Used to be cans of Coke and a bag of crisps.
Yeah, yeah. but we went and robbed a bank. And then we put the money away. And then we came back to the future so we would never get.
We wouldn't get caught.
Caught for the crime, and then we collected the money. Now, the mechanics of that didn't work, but in Dream, it made perfect sense. But the mechanics
it immediately struck a chord with me, because I think we'd had several sort of off-tangents discussion about Terminator Paradox and all that kind of thing anyway, hadn't we? Over
There's
many, over, well, not many, many, but some beers and stuff, because I'd always been angry that Terminator was wrong. And then we talked about Paradox. When in a Paradox, nothing actually can really be wrong, because it's like, you know, the whole... what Steve was talking about earlier, what was that word
we were looking for? Retcon.
Yeah, you can.
Retroactive continuity.
You can play with what you want, as we've since discovered you can, which we'll talk about later, obviously. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I said to you, off the cuff on a few occasions, oh, I've been looking for some materials for a write. I really, you know, I wanted to just, I said, I don't know if it'll go anywhere, but I just fancy writing something. And your eyebrows went up a little bit. You're like, well, we've got in mind. I said, well, to be honest, I'd like to do something script based, because all the films I watch, I want to hit my own nail in the wood, I said to you, or something profound.
Yeah, like, do you remember? Yeah, one of your profound Paulisms.
They're not always hitting the nail on the head. If I wrote my own, very Tarantino-esque, I know we'd be near the mark here, sort of thing.
We had a conversation when we watched The Dark Knight. Do you remember that night? Because Lisa and my previous place, we had that cinema in the basement, didn't we?
Yeah.
And we'd have movie nights, wouldn't we? And you'd come over one night, Andy and Steve had come over, and we'd sat down, we'd had a few beers, and we're sitting there after The Dark Knight had finished. This is long before The Dark Knight Rises. We sat down and we plotted out basically what the next movie should be, didn't we, with the Riddler and the Joker. And we'd had all these ideas about how you could have had Harley Quinn in there. You could start with a Joker in a glass cell like Hannibal. And head shaved, and we wanted Joe Gordon.
Yeah, we
Gordon.
Were bastardizing all sorts of ideas, weren't we?
Joe Gordon-Levitt would have to play the
Absolutely.
Joker.
You'd already done that photo.
I'd done the photo of him behind the cell door, hadn't I?
Yeah.
And then Harley Quinn would be the So she would start as a psychologist and then he would gradually corrupt her, and she would be somebody bringing him in materials from an admirer on the outside that would turn out to be the Riddler. And we had all these grand plans for it, didn't we? That you wouldn't see Batman in the Batsuit for most of it, because he would be Bruce Wayne in disguise as someone going into Arkham and getting to have some FaceTime with the Joker, trying to get to the Riddler. And we put all this stuff together, and then you said to me, and this is where my eyebrows went up, you said, we should write a script. And that stuck in there.
Because as we were lacing along, it was untangling so beautifully.
Yeah.
We're like, we've got the ability here to put a few ideas together. And I said to you, we've got a hackout. And I said to you, I've been wanting to write one for years, but I've never been able to find, number one, never been able to sit down and get on with it. But I said, if I was with somebody, that'd help me pull and push and pull and push along.
Yeah.
And then after that conversation, because, I mean, many, many moons after what actually became our script, we considered doing a rather menacing version of Joker Batman story, didn't we?
Yeah. There was something that, we kicked an idea around. It was all built around that original idea, wasn't it? Of it was a bit like the Red Dragon, but it was hung on the bones of Red Dragon, wasn't it? Where the Joker was the Hannibal character, the Riddler was the Tooth Fairy character, and then you had Batman trying to get to the Riddler, and he and the Riddler was enamored with Batman, and he was trying to challenge Batman. Let me see you as a hero.
He's the last person on the world I'm ever going to hurt, because it's far too much fun menacing with him. Yeah. That kind of thing,
yeah, and it was great stuff. It was like, I'm going to, he'd leave all these clues, I'm going to blow up this post office. And if you don't get there and save these people, I'm going to think less of you. And if you get there and save these people, then you've passed that test and I'll do another one. Mm. And all the while, the Joker's in Arkham pulling the strings and Harley Quinn is the go-between. And it was all coming together. All that, those things came together beautifully. But we could never get the time to do it because we poured so much time into what eventually became Hindsight.
Mm, which was a completely different story.
Completely different story. But
that's the Hindsight stemmed from this time-travelling robbery situation that we were all sort of recruited for by Pierce Brosnan, apparently.
Yeah. Or McQueen.
Yeah, or McQueen. Yeah.
Your Thomas Crown of choice.
But then you sort of laced this entire story together on Path one morning. And I think I called you within minutes. You've got something here. I said, you got something. Because I'd always been angry at the Terminator, really angry at the Terminator. Yeah. I don't know why. It was completely puerile and futile. And I said, I want to do something that breaks the rules of time travel as we know it. I want to look at situations where, like the whole Back to the Future thing, where it's like if you see yourself in a particular time zone, the universe will explode. I was like, no. I want to converse with myself.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And then it's like, we've got to have a beer, which, it's always been our best writing environment.
So always best fueled by something.
Yeah, I think we got together for a couple of beers when the pads came out and some pencils came out and we started scribbling bits and pieces together.
I've got the first notebook with the Batman on the front cover, fittingly.
But we were like, okay, we've got this idea, and we, like you say, we talked about the mechanics of the whole bank thing and literally just, okay, well, many, many years later, we'll just take out the interest. I was like, did the mechanics work? I can't remember what were the stumbling blocks on that?
The stumbling block on that was that it was ridiculous and it didn't work. And it was like,
it must have been more than that. Sure.
Yeah, no, I think that was it. I remember we sat in the Hungry Fox pub, didn't we?
Mm.
And we said, this thing, we need to stick a pin in it. We kept moving it to one side, didn't we? Like, put the bank over there for a minute because it doesn't quite work. Because if you bring money...
We wanted more than money, didn't we?
If you bring money back, the chances are the actual currency, the notes, are going to be different because they are.
Yeah, that was another thing. The notes would have been different.
But if you put it in an account somewhere and then you come back to the future and you've got decades of past, are you still going to have access to it? How can you prove?
Yeah, there was all sorts of things.
Decided eventually we put that to one side and we'll leave it there and we'll find something else was their goal.
Yeah, we decided it's got to be more than money as well.
Yeah.
We wanted something a bit more fruity and tangible and romantic, for want of a better word, I don't know. Yeah. It's just like, and then I think Relics popped up, didn't it? It's like, oh, hang on a minute.
But there was actually... Before that, there was the first thing you wrote. Do you remember that thing you sent me? I think you sent it to me on a Saturday night.
Did I write that before?
Before we sat down. That's really? Before we went to Hungry Fox. You wrote that scene in the rain where the two versions of the same guy meet each other and they get in a fight, don't they?
That would explain why I said to you, look, I want two people to face off, or yeah. I want two people to... Oh, okay,
and
yeah.
And I found that a page turn. That really lit a fire under me because I read through that and I was thinking, oh, this is interesting, oh, that's interesting. And then it just ended and I thought, what? Where? So I text you, where does this go? And he said, I've got no idea.
I've got no idea.
I thought, for Christ's sake, yeah. I've just been reading these pages and pages of really exciting visual. It was all visually based, wasn't it? There wasn't really any narrative
that's
in there.
That's the only way I that's what I do, though.
It worked really, really well. But then we got stuck on the idea of, and this is something that goes back for me to the early 90s, an idea that I'd had. And we got the idea of our protagonist being two versions of the same person.
Yeah, which I fell in love with immediately.
Which was absolutely the key that unlocked this thing, wasn't it? And I did this idea back in the 90s of doing a short comic strip because I didn't want to do anything that would make me work too hard. But it would be about a guy who, this is going to sound very familiar now, a young guy who goes and sits on a bench outside his home. And an old man comes and sits next to him and gives him a little device and says, you can do whatever you want with this, but whatever you do, when you're my age, you need to bring this back to this exam moment. And it's a time travel device. And it was an idea that a time travel device can never be created. And do you remember you and I sat in the pub that day and we said, if time travel is ever possible, we'll come back here. Is that thing from Big Bang? We'll come back here to this moment and prove it.
Mm.
And nothing happened. Obviously, time travel is never going to be possible. But if it were possible, why would it have to be built in some way? Why couldn't it just paradox itself into being? And when you've finished using it at the end of your life, bring it back and give it to your younger self with the promise that you have to bring it back at the end of your life. And that's the kind of thing that fueled our ideas, wasn't it?
We made this really cool Mobius strip situation.
That was the whole thing, wasn't it? You hit on that, the Mobius strip, yeah. So then
we started to build the characters, and I actually started sending you, we were using Messenger on the iPads, weren't we?
Yeah.
And I sent you a complete and utter typo. And
you were writing the main character.
I was writing the main character's name should be, but you received
Thompson Carr.
Was that all it said was Thompson Carr?
It had auto-corrected the main character.
Thompson Carr.
Thompson Carr.
Yeah. So, and you were like, okay,
works.
That's a typo. And you're like, no, we're leaving that.
That worked.
And the
young version is Tom.
And bizarrely, just that typo producing a name unraveled all sorts of stuff, didn't it?
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, right, we know we've got an idea. We've got a person. We've got this device. We've got a younger and an older version of him, which unfortunately, I mean, some people do it and some people don't. We did immediately, unfortunately, typecast character visuals on the people.
Yeah. It changed, didn't it, a couple of times?
It did. It did change.
So initially it was Harrison Ford and James Franco.
Or something along those lines, yeah.
Playing the older and younger versions of themselves.
Yeah, but then you saw the most obvious solution to that.
Yeah, I've been lifelong fan of this man.
Yeah, then you said, well, hang on a minute, there's these two chaps called the Sutherlands. It's like, oh, yeah, well, I can't believe we didn't see that in the first place, sort of thing.
It seemed clear to me then that that's the way it needed to go, that was the dynamic.
And it was like, well, yeah, he's got that nice old... because we were trying to deal with this. Thompson was this mature, almost tweedy gentleman.
Professorial gentleman.
Yeah, almost wearing tweed. He could almost have had a stalker and a pipe in his mouth, for crying out loud. But he had the same Earl Grey tea every day from the same barista. And bearing in mind what he did for a living, he was a bizarrely, dangerously habitual person.
Yeah.
Wasn't he? And we were that was his undoing, but it's also edgy at the same time.
Mm.
So it's like, why would you do that, knowing the situation you're constantly in, sort of thing? And then when it comes to it, he, like say, when he goes back to see his younger self, it's actually obviously Kiefer, who at the same time was doing the whole 24 thing, and he was a bit more rogue-esque, and he was a bit more, you know, a bit more daring-do about him.
Mm.
And but at the same time, even though he was doing that, he'd step back and he'd scan a situation. Sort of, and we're like, okay, we've got two characters visually that from a point of view of emotion and actor and characteristics that we can start, you know, pushing this story forward. But then we were still like, But what are they after? We still didn't really think about what they're after.
And that's when Zara entered the picture.
That's when I came up with this idea called the market, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
And basically, we decided, okay, let's say you used the idea 2020 on just a piece of paper based on my little face-to-face in the rain situation. You drew this picture. I think it was a photograph that you took in the woods.
Yeah.
And you just simply put 2020 because hindsight, obviously 2020 vision or something's already happened.
Yeah.
So we immediately said, okay, we've got to use the year 2020 as a major part of our story. But you then said, no, what we'll do is we'll go forward like another 40 years for Keitha and Donald, sort of that age situation
we're
planning. Let's have present day as 2020. And actually we're basing things on the older Thompson Cars events, more like 2065 or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
But then we both sat back and went, hang on a minute, we're dealing with time here. None of this matters.
Yeah.
But we did want a point of time where Thompson currently had purpose. He did have a sort of relationship, which is, like you say, where Zara came into it. And so we created this situation called the market. And the market was where I came up with the idea of, I think they should steal cool stuff. Everyone in the future is bored and, you know, I want a real Mona Lisa and so on.
That's
and so
right, yeah.
But I wasn't really looking at the integrity and I wasn't looking at the time structure of it. But you said one tiny, simple thing. They can't interfere with the timeline. Everything that is happening to us is completely normal. So what they could do, they could only go back and either show or offer situations that were real-time mysteries that were never solved. And that's the reason their real-time mysteries never solved. Alternatively, they came back and they couldn't snap on a twig, the whole butterfly effect situation.
Yeah.
So they could only do things where, from our point of view in real time, in an earlier timeline, it was just a mystery or it just happened that way and so on and so forth. So that happened to us, but they happened in that fashion because the market came back. That's the way.
Exactly. So it's things like
there was no imprint, wasn't there?
Yeah, there's no imprint because they were, and part of what the market did within our story is they'd come back in time and they'd take an item off the timeline at the point where it disappeared. So it might be a famous statue or a famous painting, a painting that was destroyed in a flood or a statue that was destroyed in a fire and it was never seen again and it's become this legendary thing. But what it was when it really disappeared was our guys turned up, stole it, took it to the future and sold it to a collector. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, when these things vanish and you never see them again, it's because they've been there and done their thing.
So, but it was like, well, hang on a minute, they've still stolen it. So surely that's no, because they only looked for things that were already missing in time.
And that was Zara's job, wasn't it? Zara's job in the story is to research those things and find targets.
Yes.
And one of those things, which became quite a key point in what would have been a huge elaborate action scene in the script, was the Iron Man Buddha. Do you remember that? Which is the little statue carved out of a piece of meteorite that had mysteriously, it was something the Nazis valued because it had a swastika on it or something.
And if anyone were to Google that, they would find reams and reams and reams of results, all equally intriguing, imbalanced, all sorts of things going on. Yeah.
And then there's a couple of other things. Like we said, there would be like the market is for people, like you said, that they're so wealthy and so powerful.
Over wealthy,
Now they want these trinkets. They want Jimi Hendrix guitar or they want this painting that was destroyed in the flood. But there's a subculture underneath that of people that want to go back with our guys and experience things in the past.
Mm.
Which wouldn't normally, brought us to our...
For whatever reason.
Key villains, the Collector. Dark. Very dark.
Yeah. The Collector was beautiful in his own way, though. He didn't want to hurt anyone. He just wanted to witness things that nobody else would generally want to witness. It's hard to explain. He was quite an inert character, really. But his wants were not.
It was disgusting. It was really, to write that character made your skin crawl, didn't it?
But he wouldn't raise his finger to anybody.
No, all he wanted to do was watch.
It was just a nasty intrigue he had within him.
Do you remember when we started decking out his office and we'd sort of put stuff on the desk, like when
it was a bit like you know when they scan the room and it's got Bill Skin's fifth and all that kind of thing. We were thinking about that kind of wall, weren't we, in the beginning?
Yeah, like on his desk is the copy of Catcher in the Rye that Mark Chapman had when he shot John Lennon.
Yeah,
somehow
still got a
this
of
guy's
little,
got hold of it, and there was something else on the wall from another You know, we can go on and on, can't we? Where we sat and researched all these events that he might have been witness to because he'd been able to travel back and just be there. He wanted to go back and he wanted to be across the street and watch John Lennon get shot. Or he wanted to go back and he wanted to stand in Jim Morrison's bathroom in Paris and watch him die in the tub because he's at that pitch black of a character.
Mm.
And that's where we... I mean, I don't want to give too much of the story away, but that's kind of like the...
That's who we were dealing with. That's the kind of
trigger
client
point as well.
That was one of the clients we were dealing with at the time. But he wasn't the major client. I mean, we sat down for a little while and thought about how, ironically, with the product that Thompson Carl gave people, sometimes people say, can I go back and change this for the better?
Yeah.
He'd be like, no, you can't. And it made him look like the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had another guy come back and say, look, I just want to do one thing for the common global good of all mankind, which is actually a good, nice thing to do. But Tom's been like, no, because you've got to think about the timeline. So we actually made our protagonist our antagonist and our antagonist and our protagonist both at the same time, continually throughout the story, which we just loved doing. That was so interesting.
It was so exciting to when we hit on that the villain of the piece would be pushing to do something good, and the
wonderful.
Good, we can hit the point here, I suppose. Our antagonist, wanted to stop Martin Luther King from being shot, didn't he? That's his goal.
That was one of his earlier requirements
in his
yes.
story. He'd already gone back and he'd seen Dr. King speak. That was one of the trips he'd gone on.
There's
with
actually
Thompson.
A picture of him shaking hands in his office,
and he's and then he wanted then he. Had this idea that if he could go back and just prevent that one thing from happening,
history,
particularly history of civil rights, would change
civil
completely.
Rights would have changed.
And then we had Thompson say no, because Thompson's ability to travel through time is contingent on the timeline being
the current timeline must
preserved.
Yes.
So it's unfortunate that he has to say no. This happens, but it happens because it's always happened, and the minute that changes. He loses his ability to see.
But then on the flip side of the coin, we have selfish Thompson, who without a care in the damn world, goes back in time to save his own skin, to see his younger self without a care in the world for the timeline.
But in a way, that's kind
of... desperation at the same time, though.
Yeah, and in a way, because we know, because of the way we built the story, the older version has to go to the younger version to give him the device to start the circle anyway.
He does.
So for our guy, for Thompson, the older version, for him it's a revelation, oh, this is the moment I do that. This is the moment I make that choice.
But it does still question the morality of what he did compared to what he refuses to do for other people.
Absolutely. And that's the point. Now, that's the thing. This is where we got to in our early discussions, wasn't it? How can we pursue that even further? Where can we take that choice? How can we turn that on itself? So he's made a decision to say, no, my interests are best and I'm going to go back and I'll live out my days in the past with my younger self and help build this thing up from the start. And that will be the circle. That will be the loop, the infinite loop. But we decided we wanted to turn that on him, didn't we? And put him in a situation where he would have to do something that he would not want to do, which is, I think, my favourite part of the script was the minute that we realised that Tom Carr is the man on the grassy knoll during the Kennedy assassination.
Mm.
And that was the key that unlocked so much for me. And that was the point where this thing really hit full tilt, I think. And the story started to unfold really rapidly, wasn't it? That we had to get to that point where we got our group of time travellers on that grassy knoll with a rifle, knowing that as history caught up to them, they're the guys that killed Jack Kennedy.
All the time it was them.
And that's why there's this big mystery around it. Oswald couldn't do it on his own. There was somebody seen on the grassy knoll, but when the police got there, they'd gone. And that's because in the same way as we'd already built the structure that our time travellers would drop into history and steal things off the timeline and then never be seen again, well, they also actually got embroiled in this massive, iconic crime. And they were there one minute and gone the next. And that's why this whole mystery grew out of that.
Exactly,
event. I really enjoyed that so much.
Once we latched onto that, we actually started looking at all sorts of things. We started just asking our friends, can you give us a couple of unsolved mysteries?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we had Shergar coming out of the network, and obviously Princess Diana became a part of it.
Princess Diana was a huge part, yep, wasn't she?
We even threw Roswell in for a bit of fun and so on and so forth. And that's where the whole, the creation process of what was to become our final product of the market became more fun, as opposed to the, obviously, the troubling questions you have to ask yourself: how far are you willing to go?
Mm.
Well, it, literally, how far in time are you willing to go to either create or fix a situation that you know you shouldn't create or fix, and that kind of thing. That's where it became really muddled. And the physics and mathematics behind the whole time travel situation, based on just simply asking those questions, actually started to become horrendous at one point, didn't it?
Yeah.
It was, hang on a minute, so... if that's going to create that, that's going to create that. But hang on a minute, no, because then it's going to cause, that's going to create a causality loop between this situation. And it did start to get a little, we got a lot of spaghetti in front of us. So that's when you started, well, hang on a minute, we've got to make a schematic out of this. And before we know it, there's an A4, no, an A3, isn't there, with all sorts of branches. Brain,
A thought tree, wasn't it, with all of our, everything plotted out. I remember that. I remember Lisa and I went away for a weekend, and I was sitting there with my iPad drawing all these things out, thinking, that can't go there because it gets in the way of this, and that undermines that. But then you started layering these things on top of each other, and then I found that we were starting to pull new layers in. So when we took, I mean, we've got to talk about Nolan a little bit, the character Nolan, that we, the mercenary.
Probably my favourite character in history ever.
It was a real...
And he has to be filmed.
A real labour of love. It was, and the idea was that he was Princess Diana's bodyguard, wasn't he? On the night she died.
He was.
And he was one of the guys who. This is purely our fiction, and we don't mean any disrespect about it. We were as close to the real events as possible.
No, we were dealing with his emotional problems because of such a situation. Because of it, so there was no disrespect.
So he should have been in our story. He should have been the guy driving the car that night, and for whatever reason. He cried off for that duty. He was paid off, I think we decided, wasn't it? He was paid off. And so he wasn't there to keep her safe. So the fact that she died haunted him. And then our guys go back and recruit him on the anniversary of her death in Paris. And they show him what really happened.
Mm.
And what really happened was purely an accident. And it had been sold to him as... a conspiracy, and Nolan was buying into the conspiracy, wasn't he? That she was murdered, that it was the CIA, and that it was the NSA, and that all these, and that it was the royal family.
And the one thing he wanted to do
was put it right.
And so there's another situation where he morally wants to do the right thing.
And Thompson is saying no.
And Thompson's like, no. But the irony is, Thompson needs Nolan. And Nolan wants Thompson.
and that was the fun thing to write as well, because we know that Thompson from the future looks like he's just randomly selecting these people, much like we were randomly selected in the dream I had that led to some of this stuff. He looks like he's randomly selecting people, but he's not. He's purposefully choosing the people that he knows he's worked with his entire life. And the fact that he has to go back and recruit them just to make that fulfill itself is another loop within our story, isn't it? That he has to go back and he has to find Nolan and he has to show him the truth. He has to take him to the... He takes him into the actual tunnel, doesn't he, when the car crashes?
Yeah.
And shows him. And then we have a fun little layer in there where you see the little moped that people have always spoken about.
Just another moped appears. But the moped was something else entirely. Yeah.
Was the collector and Thompson again on a trip where he wants to turn up and take those photographs of Diana in the car. And it was all very dark and all very twisted. And then... Nolan's on board, but again, you've got somebody that's joined the team who has at the back of his mind, I could do real good with this power if I could just get it away from
Thompson.
I could
just get my hands on it, which is where Nolan learns about Mogul in the future, Towns. And Towns also wants to correct things. So Nolan's next point of call is like, I need to be with a man that wants to correct things.
And that's when it really got fun.
That's where the weaving starts to go through, to the point where we actually managed to get a meeting between Nolan and Towns later on. But I won't digress on that any further at the moment.
No, let's not tell any more of the story aspects. Mm. I think I really wanted to get the Nolan character out there and introduce that concept. But let's talk about where we took the project next. Because I remember when we first sat down in... The Hungry Fox, and we had our notebooks, and we said, where can we go with this? And it was like a page of scratch ideas. And I said, I can't wait until we've got like a manuscript, a slab of paper. And then before you knew it, we had that, didn't we? Mm. And I even had some of them bound by a friend of mine, Mark,
yeah, you did.
Who was a printer,
yeah.
And got a lovely bound copies.
That was a very nice Christmas present, if I recall.
Yeah, he did us a good turn there. He's a good guy. So we had these, we had our slab of paper, and then it was second draft, third draft, fourth draft.
And there was draft, I don't know why, but we had draft 4.1. We didn't go fifth, we had 4.1 and 4.2.
Yeah, there were only minute changes, weren't there?
You went crazy about coders.
there was a lot of that stuff. I think we'll hold some of those back because...
I'm not going to mention them, but you did go crazy about that kind of thing.
That was a lot of fun to me. I'd be up late at night, just to give people an insight. I'd be sitting up late at night, before this is years before Talk Star Wars, so I was doing other writing. I was writing these little bits and I'd have an idea and then I'd write something and I'd send it to you and you were probably just about to go to sleep and read it and then you'd send me an email saying, bloody hell, you've done it again. It's another little thing that we hadn't thought about or we hadn't gone near, and it's another, you know, world of possibilities that informs everything else and becomes this exciting stuff. Do you remember that day we got in touch with Giancarlo Esposito?
Yeah, he posted a tweet on, obviously, Twitter. It was the side of a bus. Was it Revolution he was in? Something like that. What was he in?
I don't remember.
I can't remember what he was in. But he was inside of a bus, and it was like a press junket or something like that. Mm-hmm. And in response to his posted picture, I just said, at Giancarlo, blah, blah, blah. By the way, I've got something much, much bigger for you. And I actually said, for you, sort of thing, because he was, again, somebody we were toying with. We liked his style on a particular character and so on and so forth. And within moments, I got a reply from him, didn't I? And he's like, you've got my attention, ... I was like, and I just freaked out, and I didn't retweet it or anything like that, but I immediately sort of grabbed the image of that and I sent it straight to you, and you called me about 12 seconds later.
I said, what the hell is going on? Like, we've got this script, and suddenly I'm starting to doubt everything we've written, thinking, I can't believe this guy saying we've got... We got you putting that in the car, didn't you? I put Lisa in the car, and we met down a pub, which was where we do our best thinking, and we said, what the hell do we do? Where do we go with this? And eventually we managed to get the script to his company, didn't we?
I actually...
Quiet Hand Films? Was it Grace?
It was Quiet Hand, yeah. And I think I emailed first and she did reply pretty quickly. Mm. And then I called and I did briefly speak to her. And she said, look, all I can give you is you've got to send this through the correct channel. She said, by all means, send it on to me and so on. And so we did. By digital copy, and I actually then emailed her again and she said, we have it, it's now being dealt with by whoever, but then these things, as they fizzled away somewhat, but we did have literally first-hand contact with his agent, and yeah, they got a copy. I actually then tweeted him about a million times to say, have you read the damn thing?
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly these things go from being full of hope and possibility.
Mountains and molehill in an hour.
To being nothing, isn't it? It's funny. I think this has always been a double-edged sword, this project, because it was so enjoyable to write, but then what comes afterwards is it's peaks and troughs.
Big time.
Manic highs and utterly depressing lows. And we've pitched this, haven't we? We should say at this point. We have actively
to some pretty big names,
some huge names, some big studios. Warner Brothers is in there, isn't it? The little things Fox, like Endgame Entertainment and Paramount was one, I think.
I think Paramount. I did Warner.
K&O Paper Products, which is Kurtz and Altman of Star Trek. They wrote Star Trek.
I think there were three very small independents, which we owe little bit thanks to Joey of the Happy Riders. He made a couple of connections as well for us, didn't he? So
yeah, Stage 32 have also been a very useful platform.
Yeah,
to do
they're
some
Stage
of this 32
now, isn't it? Yeah.
It was all very exciting. I think the first pitch I did was over Skype to Endgame Entertainment, wasn't it? And it was 7 minutes. I've put a picture of that session on the Facebook page that we set up for Hindsight, which I believe is Facebook.com/hindsightscript, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. We've still got probably the tweet name out there somewhere.
There's a picture on, yeah, I've still got the Twitter account. There's a picture of my Mac with all these post-it notes stuck around it so that I could read my pitch off these post-it notes whilst still looking at the screen.
Yeah, it's not
and
easy.
I was terrified. I've never been so anxious in all my life. And it went really well. Went really well. But then I soon learned that in the moment, those things do go really well. Do you remember the night we came to yours and pitched?
Yep. Fox TV.
To Fox TV, pitched as a TV show, didn't we?
The irony is there.
That was cruel.
You, in your normal manner, decided that Hindsight deserved a universe.
Yeah.
And you started writing all sorts of really cool but quirky time travel stories, like winning the lottery and how did the device come around in the first place, and
that's
all these
kind
of little bits
one,
and pieces. And I was looking at one about how a guy could have affected a presidential election and all sorts of stuff like that as well.
And you did one about Jesus.
I did a guy that wanted proof on he doubted his faith.
Fantastic.
His wife was murdered in his own church, and he wanted proof of his faith because that kind of thing can't happen if there's a God. So they actually arranged for him to go and see one way or the other what happened with crucifixion and all that kind of stuff. And we actually got to a point where we had probably already written about 8 fairly solid stories, and I've given you about 2 or 3.
Yeah.
But we had ideas for about 20 or so.
Well, I think we ended up with what we had fully formed, and then what we had in thumbnails. We had about 24 stories.
We had
stories.
A season.
Yeah.
So we're talking to Fox. This young rep from Fox, and we gave him the original pitch, and we're like, okay, just add on to that because we know this is TV, blah blah blah. We've got now these 24 episodes done, wound up, is ready. We can, you know, easily pliable, adaptable. We can push them. And he was absolutely head over heels in love with the idea. And then what did he say right at the end? What you got on your hands, guys, is really a movie.
Oh God!
So, well, we've got a movie.
That was the thing that we were saying. Like this story. It's like, and you try and what we quickly learned was you try and do the elevator pitch, don't you? So you try and encapsulate everything in a. So it's like Thomas. It's like time traveling Thomas Crown Affair. It's people that travel through time and they try and steal artifacts from throughout time and sell it to this market of collectors in the future. And oh, that's a good idea. You need to lean more on that. Oh yeah, but we got this stuff with the JFK assassination and UFOs in Roswell, and it's all really exciting. We can develop these stories out, and you'll have a full season. And no, it's a film. Yeah, well, the film studios are telling us this might work as TV.
Yeah.
And that's what we soon found, that we're locked in this endless cycle of being palmed off from one genre to the next.
It gets disheartening. Then you look at the bigger pictures. What I read was it Dallas Buyers Club went through 90 agencies or something before anybody even considered putting it down. And then it's like, hang on a minute, I've been through about 12. But I mean, we also live in a world where time doesn't allow that much maneuverability on these situations all the time. But I mean, I sent details of an agency, not an agent, a studio to you literally just last week, didn't I?
Yeah, I
think it's time to blow the Hindsight bubble up again, sort of thing. And every time, I'm not kidding, every time I open that script and start reading, I mean.
Well, I read it again recently.
And I don't know how biased I am. I like to think I'm fairly fussy with my material, but that, it really knocks my socks off every time.
I think it helps because we wrote that together. And so I went back to it not long ago and read the final or the most recent draft. And I felt removed from it to a point where I could read it and enjoy it. And I thought we'd gotten a nice pace. But it's very hard to be objective about it, obviously, because we've created this thing. But I thought we got a nice pace going. And some of the stuff I love, because I think visually, like you do. So when we're writing the stuff where it's in the 60s, I'm thinking, I've written a time travel story, but I'm watching in my mind's eye this story set in the 60s. It looks like Mad Men, where these people tear us and around in Dealey Plaza having these little adventures, and there's multiple versions of characters running around at the same time trying to get one up on each other. And there's betrayal, and there's intrigue, and there's these ridiculous philosophical and moral dilemmas being posed to these characters that could never exist in the real world, but they're really interesting pressure points to push. And imagine yourself in that situation. If you had to do this thing, could you do it? How far will you go for what you think is right?
And the final, you know, the final question asked of any of the characters on that is massive. It's enormous. And I said to you, I can almost picture this scene where there's no sound. It's just a heartbeat and it's all slowed down. And we were just sitting there like, this is really coming together.
Yeah. And we're writing the character to have tears in his eyes when he's looking down the barrel of that rifle thinking, I have to do this. I have no choice.
Yeah, I mean, and from what we understand, I mean, it was all rattled off in 3 seconds. But for him, that's 3 days of pain that he's going through because he's like,
Is there a way out of this? Are we absolutely sure? I can't undo this once it's done, even though I've got all the time in the world. I can't undo this.
That's the thing. He has all the time that ever existed, ever.
Because obviously we have to remember that both these characters are the same person at different ends of the same life. What we do with the old version, the sacrifice he makes.
That was poetry.
It just kind of undoes.
That was absolute poetry.
Any perceived bad.
Seriously. And if anybody, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, let's not give that away.
No, I was going to say, if anybody looks at the pages, they might get an idea where we're going, where you went with that. I mean, where you say we wrote this together, it was very much a 70-30 or 80-20 situation.
No, I don't think so. We'd
sit down and I'd come up with these little whirlpools of ideas, which you managed to turn into 200 pages overnight. Normally.
Yeah, but it was all a lot of fun. I mean, do you remember you had a barbecue one night, which is the night where Movie Geeks Film News was born, actually, their previous blog and podcast. You had a barbecue at your place and I walked past you and said, oh, by the way, Kennedy lives, and then walked off. And he said, no, you can't just drop a morsel like that and not explain to me how you came to that. But that was the way I was trying. I was at my wit's end, trying to write myself out of the corner I'd put myself into, and I thought, oh, well, just let Kennedy live so they can see what the alternate take on this situation would be.
It was also a case of, in reality, could our character do this?
Yeah.
You were like, well, maybe he can't.
Yeah, but we'll give him a chance not to, and then that will show him what he has to do.
Yeah, yeah. On a tangent, I mean, you said, you know, there's multiple characters all running around DD Plaza and so on. He's one of a team of a few. I'm not going to talk about any other team members. What I'm going to say is, though, every single one of them is bound into, number one, the need to be a part of Thompson's timeline, for want of a better word, in a very emotional and particular way. Mm. And you were stunningly beautiful with the writing based on a couple of these characters. And I mean, I'm going to throw out the twins especially was... Yeah. Phenomenal, I thought. I just said to you, we need a couple of mavericks that really don't give a crap.
Yeah.
And they don't give a crap because, well, various reasons. But at the same time, I said, we'll just use a couple of surf dudes. That'd be, you know, a couple of ultra sports freaks. And you were like, oh, that's a great idea. But the way you made attached emotion to those two was beautiful.
It was very,
really loved it. Yeah.
I realized that what we ended up with was we had a collection of characters that had some duality. So you had two sides of Thompson, and then we had these twins, and then you had all these characters that had alternate versions of themselves. Even Towns, the villain, had a version of himself that he wanted to be. If he could have undone this injustice in the past, he could have become something else. The same with Nolan. We're talking about they're almost trying to retcon themselves in actuality. And so I saw this duality, and then we had... The twins, who for all intents and purposes were absolutely identical genetically, and I wanted to make them fundamentally different as characters by putting them in a situation where one guy felt the pain of an event that the other one would never know. And we managed to give the guy who had this pain a way out using time travel, and he was burdened with that pain. With that, he got a glimpse at a world, without giving too much away, he got a glimpse at a world he never wanted to experience.
Yeah.
And then the brother had no idea. So you could have one person that's been deeply affected by this profound experience and the other person who's still this joyful, wistful, free spirit that isn't.
But both their physical beings and their physical characters and their storyline were completely symbiotic of each other. So there was like three levels of characterization going on, and every single one of them, one was totally dependent on the other for totally opposing reasons, if you like. Yeah. It was, yeah.
The reasoning,
their characters, and obviously the fact that they were twins.
And then we can have fun with them in some of the more action-oriented scenes.
Stupid fun, yeah.
Stupid fun. Like wild adventure, Indiana Jones styles. I mean, I'm not saying that we wrote an Indiana Jones movie. That was
far from it.
Yeah, it's far from that level, but it's that spirit of this matinee-style like train heist with floating cars and all sorts of wild stuff. Mm-hmm. It was so much fun to write. And a lot of fun to read back even now.
The fundamental need to, number one, possibly bring in the need for some advanced future technology into whatever time zone they're in, but it had to be used or disguised in such a way that real-time events, nobody ever knew the difference.
Yeah.
That was another interesting way of trying to apply things. Because generally eyewitness statements on the most sort of bizarre happenings are not 100% accurate on what they might have seen. So we were able to play with that a little bit. People, I've seen tests on this as well. It's quite intriguing, where an event that might shock someone, even when it's play acted, when they recall it later, they will say things that are so far away from what actually happened at the time. It's quite scary, to be honest. And when you come to think of real crimes that happen in the world and witness statements that are given to some of these crimes, you're like, whoa. And some of the tests that were carried out are quite intriguing, to be honest. So we were able to play with that a little bit with the story, obviously.
Mm. Yeah, and some of these things, I thought it was a lot of fun to lean on real life events like Roswell. And I try and look at that from a different perspective and say, what if you, on the outside, everyone's looking at it thinking UFO, but what if you're on the inside of it thinking, oh no, this is just technology. Yeah. And it's technology that doesn't belong here, not from another place, but from another time. And that was a lot of fun, those sorts of things. And then how we tie that all back in towards the end of the story with
that's actually an extremely pivotal scene.
It is a
massively pivotal scene. As much as it was fun,
yeah, and that's part of the fun for me is to some of the best stories, some of the greatest stories I've seen. Not highbrow stuff, even stuff like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I don't know if you remember they did Andy, our friend Andy, is in love with that show, but
completely.
They did an episode that was all musical. I don't know if you ever saw that. It was all everybody sung their dialogue, and there was these beautiful scores and elaborate dance routines. But right in the middle of that, they dropped a massive bombshell about the character, a huge reveal that completely changed the character in context. And Joss Whedon chose to do that in this huge, campy, musical episode.
Simple genius.
So incredible. Mm. And that's what I tried to do with some of the stuff that we put together in hindsight, was try and deliver these wild adventures, but inside of it was something really dark and heavy for that character. You know, not necessarily for the story as a whole, but for that moment, for that character, that this one thing in amongst all this pomp and explosions
it's got a fearful but an emotional burden attached to it.
Yeah, it's great Big stuff. Fun. I love it. I sincerely hope at some point somebody will read this and at least give us some feedback, because you know we both know that we need to get back and write another draft. That's the bottom line.
There's
no point in moving forward with the one that's been we've been told no to 1,000 times. No point in moving forward with the same one. We need to rewrite something, but I want to be able to do that with some sort of positive input from somebody somewhere. So if you're a film executive, Mr. Spielberg, if you want to make a time travel story that's never been seen before.
I'm selfish. You know, I'm not selfish. Yeah, no, I'm a bit selfish. The world don't know what they're missing, frankly.
No, at the moment, there's a very small audience of people that have read this. I know Lisa, my wife, loves it. Absolutely loves Hindsight. And is completely gutted that it hasn't gone anywhere. But you know, this happens, doesn't it?
Mm. And then we talked about novelizing it as well, which I, depending on my mood, I will ramble into very much a sort of a novel approach of writing, won't I? I'll describe a hall for 12,000 lines, and I'll talk about what he's thinking about as he's looking at the hall, blah, 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 which you can't do scripting. You can't do scripting, which is why you were much better at the script situation than I was. I'd sit there with you and I'd ramble on for 15 minutes about, okay, he walks in here, he feels this, he does that, blah, blah. But you were able to turn that into you were able to paraphrase those things correctly into a script style explanation and the action.
Visualizing
and
it, isn't it?
Visualizing it, you know, with words, where I could visualize it in my head, but I couldn't write the damn stuff down half the time. And then based on that, you were able to come up with the correct dialogue between the characters based on the kind of conversations we'd already had.
Yeah. What exposition needs to be dropped in this brief exchange?
And then this happens because of this, and this is where he says this.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And then we go back and rewrite it and polish that stuff up so it's not so on the nose, and maybe give somebody one half of that line and somebody else the other half of that line. That's where the twins would come in handy for those sorts of bits and pieces, wouldn't they? So that it's not just somebody saying, tell me this like I'm an idiot, or, you know.
The other guy would say, you are an idiot, but
you're
right.
You are an idiot, yeah. Please don't say Back to the Future, all those little quippy things that we loaded in there. I love it. I love hindsight. And one day we'll get back to it. But I think that at least now with this episode of the After Dark Side, people get a taste of what we've done. Yeah. And
if we get half of the normal listeners, stay on a little bit, have a listen. If they want to know any more, get in touch with us.
Yeah.
Obviously, we can happily farm out tidbits. We can tell you a little bit more characterizations. But more importantly, if anybody is really interested in turning it into something a bit more meaty, then of course we'd love to talk, because we think we've got a product on our hands that the world would enjoy, seriously.
Yeah, there was definitely something to this. At one point it was a TV show. That night I seriously thought it was going to happen. In fact, Lisa and I looked at the bank balance the next day and said, can we get me to LA in case this guy says this is a go? Can we get me there for a week?
It seemed so positive, didn't it?
So positive. And then the next day it was just no. It's
pass.
It belongs on the big screen, which I think is just code for there's nothing for me here.
I did a couple of silent pitches, didn't I, where I just sent it off to the agents, and then you put in a frame, you put in a synopsis and a log line, and it's literally a 2-page read, and then they said, give us the rest, gave the rest. No, we're not doing that kind of material at the moment.
Yeah, that's so, a shame.
Well, if this is the moment, and if no one's doing this kind of material, this is the moment. But unfortunately, Hollywood is number one fashionable and number two non-fashionable, because they will occasionally bring out something that is very left field and they'll make a killing from it. But unfortunately, they also wait for things that are happening in a certain vein, and they produce another thing in the same along vein because that's what they think everyone's going to see.
Yeah.
So
a good way to wrap this episode up, Paul.
Take a risk, guys. We've got a good meaty material on our hands.
What was that... What was the feedback we had from the last written post? We don't have to say who it went to. It was a player. But what was the feedback he gave us? Because we couldn't get our head around that.
You're talking about the actual script itself from an actual product?
Yes.
We sent 4 pages.
Was it only 4?
Okay. I think it was only 4. No, it wasn't, was it? It was the first 10 pages.
It was the first 10 pages.
Which would have encapsulated two reasonably meaty scenes at that point. One of them really dark and interesting, and the other one essential to ongoing plot. But he seemed to care more about the grammar.
He cared about the grammar, and he cared about the formatting.
A couple of typos and formatting.
Which you can't.
He gave us 2 lines on essence of story, which he said was rather stilted. I was like, stilted? Have you seen the opening scene to Speed? It's a lift scene.
Yeah. What about when he said it's not original, but these films have much more success if they're based on a comic book or a video game.
He said, sorry, I forgot that bit. This isn't original material. Why don't you write something based on a comic book? Because you just told us it's not original material, and that's when I decided. I don't know, I can't remember who the agency was, but the guy was just a jerk. But I'm sure there's lots of amazing people out there that will find this really enlightening.
if you happen to be a writer and you've ever than you've ever faced this sort of resistance, it's you'll understand how infuriating it can be.
Some comments are a little crazy, to be honest. Yeah. And immediately the amount of people that just compared this to a movie of a similar vein, even though when we're giving the product in, it said, please give us the name of a movie this is similar to. So we did. And they said, oh, this is like that movie, blah, blah, blah. We're like, we know. You asked us to put that in the comparison block. Yeah. And actually then you saw the movie and you said, it's nothing like it.
Yeah. That's awful. And I'd also said to a couple of people, like In-Game Entertainment, for example, I said, look, we've given out...
Didn't you start with that?
I started with it. And I said, but the difference is we've given our characters... How did I phrase it? I say we gave them... it was something along the lines of, I've given compelling motivations or something. Oh, I can't remember what the term was now. But it was like, you know, you're not gonna see the motivations these guys have got. You're not gonna see it anywhere else. We've given them something quite unique in terms of motivation. You don't get that in that other movie, which I love, but you don't get it in that other movie. This guy, you're going to be rooting for the bad guy because you're going to be sympathetic with what he wants. That's what I said. I said, we've given our protagonist and our antagonist compelling motivations. And they said, oh, what do you mean by that? And I explained, you're going to want the bad guy to get his way because it's a great thing. And you're going to hate the hero for trying to stop it, but you know that he has to. And, you know, you don't see that everywhere. You don't see that anywhere.
Mm.
I love it. And I think people would enjoy it if they got to see it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's nice talking about it again, to be honest.
It is, yeah. It's nice to know it's still alive in there somewhere.
Yeah, well, we like it. So we keep doing little things like this now and again. We can keep punching it out.
We will. And perhaps we'll do something with...
Fat Lady's not singing yet, mate.
Yeah, not yet. Perhaps we'll do some with some of the other bits and pieces that we fit on over the years as well.
Mm. Next thing we can do is down. Send it. We should give it to all the VIPs.
That's not a bad idea. VIPs, keep an eye on your inbox. Yeah. Right, let's wrap this up.
Right.
I'm Talk Star Wars on Twitter.
I'm MovieScore on Twitter. Sorry, I'm MovieScore _.
What, you've got to clear that name up at some point.
I can't. It's taken. I've got to find
the movie score.
No, I'm not the Facebook. Facebook was never a the.
All right, we're out of here. We'll see you guys next time.